hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting in a foreign dive. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Oh, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on White Resistance Radio. Excuse me, .com. Well, lots more news and views. excuse me. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And those people are, of course, the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, much of the news over the weekend was dominated by a bizarre incident of some Hasidic Jewish rabbi's house in a suburb of New York City that's very heavily Hasidic or Orthodox Jewish, where an intruder just burst in with a knife and stabbed five people and then fled and was eventually caught. And, of course, there was the usual boo-hoo-hoo-hoo about anti-Semitism, and the mayor made a fiery statement, and the governor made a statement, and so on. Now, I don't approve of people being stabbed. I don't approve of the disruption of, a sort of a religious ceremony, the seventh day of Hanukkah that was going on in the house. I don't approve of this, but I don't think any reasonable person or decent person would. But let's see what's going on here. Number one, I don't mean to sound callous about it, but nobody died. Obviously it's not nice to be stabbed, of course, not suggesting for a second that it is. But nobody died. The same weekend, probably a couple of dozen, if we're lucky, people were murdered in Chicago. Almost all of them blacks, wasting black, probably in disputes over drug turf and the like. none of that mayhem rates anything more, makes any notice whatsoever on CNN or on the big national news. I'm sure it's a minor story in Chicago. Does that mean that you know maybe some people are more important than others? At least in the minds of the mass media. I don't know, but even more intriguing is the nature of the person who accused of the stabbing, the person who was arrested. Now, anytime anti-Semitism is mentioned, of course there's a baleful accusatory eye cast on anybody who is a nationalist, a white nationalist. You must be an anti-Semite, and therefore you must either approve of this, or maybe you're somehow involved. In fact, I was asked by a policeman who's investigating me in terms of Canada's notorious hate law, whether I was, you're known as anti-Semitic. I didn't bother to reply. First of all, this is a reputation spread by the lying, fake news, false news, lamestream media. that's like, are you asking Donald Trump, are you a bad guy? Well, the media says you are. Yeah, the media says it, and the media lies. It's a charge that, frankly, I don't think it is worth refuting or trying to refute. I'll tell you why, because it's a term and an accusation that's endlessly elastic. What is an anti-Semite? And I won't play games with the word, although one can legitimately. The Semites are a linguistic group in the Middle East. Very few Jews are actually Semites. The Arabs are Semites. Very few, most Jews are the descendants of a tribe of Turkic people, the Khazars, who converted to Judaism en masse in the 7th century AD. Khazaria lies in north of the Black Sea, in some of what might today be the Ukraine. Okay, so strictly speaking, if you are critical of Jews, you're not an anti-Semite. I won't play that game. In common parlance, anti-Semitism is opposition to or criticism of Jews. Okay, so we'll take that as a rough definition. Well, why shouldn't one be critical, I mean, if legitimately critical, of any group, or of many members of a group, or as Representative Dr. David Duke maintains, Jewish supremacists? Not all Jews are. Jewish groups, particularly in Canada, the United States, and the United Kingdom, are fiercely anti-free speech. But there are exceptions. There are Jews, for instance, like the late George Jonas, an author, columnist in Toronto, Barbara Emile, his one-time wife, and Gilad Atzmon in Britain, who are Jews, or were Jews, and are strongly in favor of free speech. So I'm always a little leery of broad generalizations, the Jews, or the Chinese, or the Americans. I think you have to be specific, and I think you also have to allow for the fact that there are individual exceptions. This seems like a long way back to defending oneself against the charge of anti-Semitism. Because it's so elastic, and it can mean almost anything. How do you defend yourself against, well, almost anything? And so I prefer simply to sidestep the question and say, I feel free as a thinking human being to criticize Jews or Jewish groups in some cases, or any other group or people, when I think with legitimate reasons that they might be wrong. And that doesn't make me against the people as a whole, but against wrongdoing. I'm very critical of politicians as a group. I think many are corrupt, cowardly, shallow. On the other hand, I think there are some outstanding ones. Just to take one off the top of my head, the leader of the People's Party of Canada, Maxime Bernier, another man who was in many ways the architect of John Diefenbaker's Northern Vision, the late Alvin Hamilton, a Saskatchewan school teacher. So it's a difficult, accusation of anti-Semitism, it's difficult to defend oneself against, and it's deliberately so, because the meaning is so lasting. Anyway, almost immediately, there were dark references in the lamestream media about the growth of anti-Semitism and so on. And I've commented before that a few incidents, like in New York City, where apparently somebody tossed a cup of coffee at a Jew and I think said something like, "You fucking Jew," and somebody shoved a middle-aged Jew and said something nasty. These, you know, relatively nothing burger incidents are conflated into a into a firestorm of hatred of Jews, and it's all quite frankly bullshit. As I've mentioned before, but I think it's well worth mentioning again, if any other group had been the victim of such relatively minor offenses, would it command the attention of the mass media? Young whites are frequently assaulted and called far worse in the mixed schools of America. That doesn't even make the local newspaper, let alone the national news. The fact is that Jews as a group in the United States, in Canada, in Britain, have immense power, immense respect. Politicians would rather cut a hand off than offend the Jewish community. They don't care if they offend white people or don't care if they offend Christians, but they know the power of the organized Jewish lobby. The people, even people who would deny it, you see, you're in a catch 22. If you somehow say Jews are not important and don't have any power, well, then you're not recognizing the achievements of the Jewish community, and therefore you're anti-Semitic. If you do say, though, Jews have an awful lot of power, in fact, disproportionate amount of power compared to their numbers, well, which is true, then you're anti-Semitic. So you can't win. And even if you keep your mouth shut, you see what I mean. The point being the fact that these relatively minor incidents, not perhaps the stabbing, but the others, that they receive the tremendous attention that they get, suggests a group of people with very considerable power. And anyway, back to the stabbing, which certainly is weird. You know, what sort of guy, I mean, unless he's a member of the family or a close member of the community, would break into or force his way into a rabbi's house for the purposes of stabbing people? It just sounds weird. Well, here's something that didn't really catch the mainstream media's attention. If you see a picture of the guy, he's a well-built, swarthy man with a beard, who's black. And here's why you won't hear much about the perpetrator. First of all, there were no guns involved. So there's not the good old gun control spin that the media will stir up after any shooting. The attacker was black, so there's no white supremacy handle that they can beat us with. I find that very interesting, and the Daily Stormer asks, and I think it's a very very good question. If this had been a story of a black guy breaking into a Christian home and stabbing five people during, say, Christmas prayers or Christmas dinner, you literally would not hear about it at all. It might make the local news. And what do they do when Jews are attacked by blacks is to try not to show the pictures of the attacker and sort of vaguely imply that it was a white person, and then mostly talk about the rising tide of anti-Semitism, or in the general way, blame the internet. The rising tide of anti-Semitism is just a crock. Although sometimes the behavior of people, of some of the Jewish community, invites dislike. An interesting fact, I think, is that the incidents, the recent incidents, including the shooting, I think it was killing of three people at that kosher establishment in Jersey City, was also perpetrated by blacks. Members of this black Israelite group, and what their beef with Jew, the other Jews, is not quite clear to me, but there might indeed be a black increased conflict between blacks and Jews in the United States, and there's a good reason for that. And the good reason is that blacks tend to have more dealings, and sometimes bad dealings, with Jews than many whites do. Blacks are often in slum housing, which is sometimes, or the slum landlord is often seen to be a Jew, or they have to shop in overpriced local stores that are often run by Jews. So their interactions with Jews are sometimes not the best, and that gives way to a certain animosity. Talk about the endless degeneracy foisted upon white people. Here's Teen Vogue. Smart girls speak up. Smart girls speak up. And this is guest edited by Rowan Blanchard and Yara Shahidi. Yara is negress of some sort. Anyway, well, what's one present? Well, the present in the Teen Vogue is Welcome to Anal Sex 101. And Daily Stormer comments, the first gift was a guide to destroying Uranus. Whatever one might think about anal sex, I don't see that as anywhere near a proper discussion or feature for Teen Vogue. And well, what's the second feature? Well, the second feature is, please talk to your family about politics, even if it's uncomfortable. Please use your privilege as a white person to protect people of color. There's all sorts of fallacies in this. First of all, there isn't any such thing as white privilege. If anything, the Zeitgeist with the traitors in power is to disadvantage people because they're white. What's affirmative action, or in Canada we call it employment equity? Well, it's deliberate discrimination against whites in favor of certain privileged minorities. This article goes on. White people need to hold other white people accountable. Here are some real-life quotations that from this piece of cultural poison. One, trust black people and people of color. Well, why should we? Why should we? Or why should we trust them any more than we trust white people? Quotation, please talk to your family and friends about politics, even if it's uncomfortable. Please use your privilege as a white person to protect people of color. Further advice, the good news is that white allies always have the chance to challenge the people close to us, whether it's at a dinner table with family or at the office during a team meeting. This should be as simple as explaining how white privilege protects white people, like Senator Gillibrand said, or it could be a more complicated conversation about the nuances of racism and how it's upheld in subtle ways. Yeah, anti-white racism. So they're telling teenage girls, I guess, to act a little bit like Greta Thunberg. How dare you to interrupt family meetings at meals to call their relatives racist. This is absolutely evil. As you know, these people are telling you to use the time with your family to push the agenda of black people on your own family. And the Daily Stormer comments, and forgive me if this is a little crude, that this is worse than telling you to take it up the ass. And there's a lot of truth in that. Making a teenage girl, I don't mean to disparage anybody for their lack of experience, but to turn a teenage girl into a preachy little Greta Thunberg at Christmas dinner, how not to be popular. But they're turning these young people, would like to turn them into propaganda agents. this is a very good short video presentation by Dr. Kevin MacDonald, and of course he's the editor of the Occidental Quarterly. There's an Occidental Comments Online. He was a professor of psychology for many years at the University of California in Long Beach, and he has written very extensively on Jewish influence in the politics of the West. And this is a good sketch background of the catastrophic Immigration Act of 1965 and who was behind it. This is a presentation by Dr. Kevin MacDonald, How Our Borders Were Opened.
Watershed event in immigration history until 1965 was the law of 1924. Until that time, America's borders had been pretty open to immigration. Of course, at that time, most of the immigrants came from Europe, but increasingly from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And that was creating a problem, because these people were different from Western European immigrants who had come before, who were assimilating quite easily. And I don't think there was ever going to be a big problem with Italian immigration or Eastern European non-Jewish immigration. Those people were a little more difficult to assimilate, certainly. But the big problem was Jewish immigration. Jewish immigrants came to this country, and they were very, very different from the people who were here before. And the most important difference was that they were deeply committed to these leftist political agendas. If you go over to Eastern Europe at that time, political radicalism was a Jewish subculture. A lot of them were intensely Zionists and so on. It was this hotbed. Because Jews were under extreme pressure in Eastern Europe. Their populations had expanded. A lot of them were impoverished. And their response to this was to become politically radical. So when they came to this country, they were A, poor, but they were B, politically radical. A lot of them were Zionists. They were extremely intense. these were the people who were organizing all these radical leftist movements. They were revolutionary. They supported the Soviet Union. And Americans were just horrified at this. And beginning, actually, early in the 20th century, there was attempts, and even in the 1890s, to shut down immigration. Jewish activist organizations were at the forefront of keeping it open. And of course, their main interest in those years was to get more Jews over from Eastern Europe. So there was a movement in this country to end this free immigration from Europe or elsewhere. So it came to the head in 1921, they finally passed a law. And the purpose of the law really was to create an ethnic status quo. They didn't try to ship the people back that were already here. But they felt that these people were not assimilating well, and we needed a timeout. And the whole point was to create an ethnic status quo. So the idea of the 1924 law, that finally solidified all this, was to retain the ethnic proportions that were in the country as of the 1890 census, and then later as of the 1920 census. So the point was to have an ethnic status quo. So their future immigration would be based on what percentage you were of the country as of 1920. This was seen fair to the people who were behind it, but of course Jewish activist organizations rejected this. They wanted more of the people to come over here. They described it as racist and so on. And basically what was going on was that the great majority of people in the country were finally saying that they had an ethnic interest in preventing future immigration. They wanted the country as it was. They wanted to be a European, Western European culture. Other groups were welcome, and they would welcome the contributions, but they did not want to be overwhelmed. They didn't want to lose the culture and the ethnic mix that was characteristic of the country at that time. Of course, Jewish organizations lost this battle. So then, after the 1924 bill passed, Jewish organizations didn't stop trying to change it. But then, in the 1930s, you had the Great Depression, and so it was even harder to change the law. You know, we're not going to allow millions of people in the country when they're already 25% unemployed. But nevertheless, they kept pushing, especially for Jewish immigrants from Europe, because at that time there was the rise of Hitler. And so they kept trying to change things. But nothing much changed until after World War II, the immigration battles heated up again. The 1952 law that was finally passed basically reaffirmed the 1924 law. It was passed over President Truman's veto. Jewish activist organizations were deeply involved in trying to overturn this legislation. So between 1952 and 1965, they never stopped. They kept creating organizations, funding organizations. Finally, by 1965, with the landslide in 1964, bringing Lyndon Johnson in, the Great Society and all that, the immigration law was finally overturned. All the ethnic quotas that were built into the 1924 law were overturned as racist. It was promised at that time that it wouldn't change the ethnic balance of the country, but certainly in the minds of the activists who were behind it, that was just a ruse. They knew darn well that they were attempting to change the ethnic balance of the country. And after that law was passed, one of their main goals was simply to increase the ceilings on immigration. In other words, to increase the absolute numbers. Once you got rid of ethnic origins as a criterion, other parts of the world were fair game.
1965, America was about more than 90% white. In fact, there are more Americans of Swiss descent in 1960 than of Mexican. Today, about 1 in 10, actually I think it's edging towards 1 in 9 Americans is a Mexican. Not literally a Mexican national, although there are many of those, but of Mexican descent, and that's a remarkable change in 30 to 40 years.
The reforms in immigration that have completely altered this country had not been the result of popular sentiment. They've been the result, really, of elite sentiment and, frankly, you know, ethnic interest group lobbying and so on. Since 1924, they lost that. Jews have had a huge animosity towards the culture that they did have. Jews, as I said, have it because they see Western culture as fundamentally anti-Jewish, going back to the Middle Ages. They have wanted to essentially end European domination of this society. And I think they're well on the way to doing it.
When something bad happens, there's a reason. And the reason that the borders were open is that the Jews opened them because they wanted to mix in tens of millions of third worlders because they thought it would be safer for them. They're more safe in a diverse society. That's the reason.
The current critical issue is the issue of Jewish power. And by the way, this is not simply Jews, it's the ideology that these Jewish leaders have, and most Jewish organizations have, that they believe that they have a divine right to rule us, to be supreme over us. It's a supremacy. It's not even a separate ideology, or it's not a separatism, it's not an egalitarianism. It is a supremacy position. Judaism, at its root, is a racial supremacist religion. And their power in media, and their power in government, today, not only in America, but their influence is great, of course, in England, and it still reaches another European country, so it's not as great as it is here. It influences every other issue, whether you're talking about gun control, or whether you're talking about abortion, or whether you're talking about world trade, or whether you're talking about the Iraq War, or whether you're talking about affirmative action. This issue is a critical issue, because by controlling our mass media to a great extent, they're able to dictate what happens. By controlling the politicians, they're able to dictate what happens on not just the issues affecting Israel, but many other issues affecting America. For instance, Americans are shocked. A lot of typically conservative Americans who are very much opposed to mass immigration, which is transforming our nation into a third world country, they are very surprised to learn that immigration, the change in Americans' immigration policy, opening our borders, that this policy was almost entirely led and affected by the Jewish supremacists. Almost every Jewish organization in the last 70 years, in fact, it took them 70 years, they started their work to undermine our immigration policy from literally the turn of the 20th century. So starting from around 1900, it took them 65 years. For 65 years, they worked to destroy America's demographic base, to make European Americans into a minority. And of course, in my book, Jewish Supremacism, I quote from many Jewish leaders bragging about the fact that they led this effort. And of course, they not only led it in terms of the actual congressional legislation, they also led it from the standpoint of the media, trying to tell people in America that somehow multiculturalism was a great advantage, that it was going to be a great benefit to people, when we know that so-called multiculturalism leads to greater crime, dislocation, racial insensitivity, in fact, racial tensions arise from it. That a community's sense of brotherhood and togetherness and unity is destroyed by so-called multiculturalism. And when we look around the world and we see multicultural states, multicultural communities, they tend to be far more violent, they tend to be far more disruptive. There's a lot less love and a lot more hate in those kinds of environments because it's human nature. People are different. But anyway, the people who have been the architects of this change have really been Jewish supremacists. So, unless we strike at that core ideologically, unless we expose this Jewish supremacist domination over our media and government, we're never going to have any real victories on these other peripheral areas.
It was basically the 1965 Act that eliminated the National Origin Quota System and the Asian Pacific Triangle. Up to that year, you had 125 Asians that were permitted to come in here, all based upon the discriminatory parts of American policy. The Torah and the Talmud teach us that we must welcome the stranger in our midst. It's written in Leviticus that the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
If we review the time of the 1965 immigration law, was widely stated by Teddy Kennedy and many others that this act would not change the ethnic balance of the country. And yet the very same people who were behind this law immediately, as soon as it was passed, did everything they could to increase the numbers to the point now where it's about a million legal immigrants a year, plus uncounted hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants.
Chinese, we just recently had some Croatians. Last summer, a great number of Brazilians. Nothing from everywhere. Guatemalans and Salvadorians and Colombians.
Very interesting to look at what Jewish organizations have done recently. They have aligned with Mexican-American groups, they've aligned with Asian groups, they've aligned with black groups. In other words, they see themselves as part of a coalition of ethnic groups, and they're self-consciously so. And those groups are going to become increasingly strong as time goes on because they're representing a greater and greater percentage of the population. But they see themselves, I think, as they have between the time they got here, as opposing the interests of European Americans. I don't think there's any question about that. The people who oppose the immigration, they talk about, well, there are economic problems and this and that. Nolan simply says, Europeans are not going to benefit from this as a group, that we are giving up control of our country to other peoples. But there's a huge problem with this.
that when you are a minority group, you better hope that the other groups in society are nice to you. Well, we Europeans should be concerned that our future will be as a minority group, and we will then be at the whim of coalitions that may have very hostile tendencies, that we will lose control of our own future. That's the issue here. It's as simple as that. But even raising European ethnic interests is the big taboo of this period right now. We can't even raise the possibility that Europeans have ethnic interests. It's the taboo topic. And yet everybody else has ethnic interests, which are legitimate.
The idea that diversity is a strength in mixing people is not a strength. The strength comes from the homogeneity and having people who are basically alike. I mean, diverse people break up because they don't want to be around the other people. That's just natural. You don't see diverse species getting together and mingling in nature. You see them avoiding each other or fighting for territory. The white man knows all this. He doesn't know his level of facts and specific understandings, but he senses the spirit of the time. No rational person would open the border with Mexico for 100 reasons.
Yeah, I think that ethnic conflict, we can already see that on the horizon. I think we're already getting to the point in this country, white people are now 70%. As you get towards 50%, you're going to see increasing amounts of that, where other ethnic groups are simply going to start flexing their muscles, and they're going to demand a greater presence of, say, Spanish in the public place. You're going to see more Spanish spoken in the public arenas. We're going to see the decline of Western culture. We're going to see increases in affirmative action directed at underachieving minorities. And I think young white people, they are going to feel the brunt of this. And one of the problems I think right now is that most middle-class white people don't feel these pressures. Their children are going to feel them. And I think it's the children who are going to change and start to exert their interest. Because if they don't exert their interest, they're going to be the first group in history that hasn't exerted their interest. It's as simple as that.
The problem is for the next generation. That's when the hurt's going to come by. You know, you can't have a country. I think the Roman Empire proved it. The Roman Empire was very aggressive, was very strong. They ruled half of the world, I guess. And so what happened after they ruled half of the world? They got soft in body and mind. They had all these slaves coming, do all their work and did everything for them. So what happened? Eventually the slaves took over. The Roman Empire just was thrown away. You gotta stay organized. One language, one group of people.
And that was an excellent commentary by Kevin MacDonald. I think it very, very neatly sketches out what was done to us and done via treason, and you know, not to mince words, but that's what it was. Here is an interesting critique in the National Post. About some of the generational conflicts that are going on. And the nonsense perpetrated by some of the brainwashed young social justice warriors. And the author talks about a recent Pocahontas scandal at Toronto's Ryerson University, in which the student union president over a social justice week workshop called Generations of Resistance, where an international student described as indigenous on her own land, sang Colors of the Wind from the Disney movie Pocahontas as a way to describe her own personal resilience. The head spins. Yeah, you're a privileged student at a North American university. You may have come from, you know, she's an indigenous person on her own land. I guess she's from some other country. Anyway, another student politician who is indigenous said the song triggered her and could have been traumatic to others because it reminded her of another song in the movie called Savages. As reported by the Eye Opener, that's the student newspaper, the student union president pledged to vet musical performances at social justice workshops in the future to prevent such cultural appropriation. You want to say, look, go out and get a job and enter the real world. So some of these people are just emotionally unstrung. Emotion set these social justice warriors apart. If the young are drowning in performative empathy, the old are parched. Now, this was illustrated in Nova Scotia recently after a young alumna of St. Francis Xavier University took offense on Facebook that the new Brian Mulroney Institute of Government features a quote from the former Prime Minister's father. And he said, "The only way out of paper mill town is through a university degree." Brian Mulroney grew up in Bay Como, which was a town on the north shore of the St. Lawrence. It was largely a paper mill town, although his father actually worked for the railway. Anyway, the student took a great exception to this. "As a social worker in training, I need to speak out against oppression and discrimination," Megan Mary Landry wrote in defense of the residents of mill towns, including herself, who should not be regarded as impoverished and embarrassing. Now, of course, this was widely mocked. Getting out of mill towns and fishing villages is what maritime life was all about in Mulroney's childhood, that'd be in the 50s and 60s. It still is. That is literally Sonny's dream. But it was not just the young person who complained who got mocked. The university itself was haranguing for apologizing. To the young, it looked like a school had humbly listened to criticism and apologized for inadvertently causing a microaggression. In the mind of some social justice warrior who is not even yet a trained social worker, to the older generation, it looked like an uppity scold on Facebook bullied the school's president into submission and debasement when he should have fought back. And I think that there are many, many other examples rather neatly outline the war. We're still in the Christmas season, and I'm very happy to play a few Christmas songs by a wonderful lady, country western singer in Nashville, Tennessee, Julie Keach Harris, and this is from her CD, Christmas Dreams. So let's see, these are a few of Julie Keach Harris's Christmas songs, Christmas Dreams. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on Like Resistance Radio. Jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell chime in jingle bell time. Dancing and prancing in jingle bell square.
Dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. one for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, I will hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying. My dear, we're still goodbying. As long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Tonight.
chimney, so Mama must have let him in. Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him. Well, they thought I was fast asleep, they thought I was tucked in bed. They never thought I'd come a-peeping, or that I'd hear what was said. Santa put his arm around Mama, and Mama put her arm around him. So if Santa Claus ain't Daddy, I'm gonna tell on them. Well, Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him. It's not the way I had him pictured. Santa was a much too thin. He didn't come down the chimney, so Mama must have let him in. Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him. He must have been. Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him. Well, Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him. It's not the way I had him pictured. Santa was a much too thin. He didn't come down the chimney, so Mama must have let him in. Santa looked a lot like Daddy, or Daddy looked a lot like him.
Julie Keach Harris, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. I want to play you a song by a Canadian country and western singer, and he lives in Ontario, actually, in, excuse me, he lives in Colborne, Ontario, and this is called the Christmas Song. The singer is Don Murdoch, and just about to play this for you. It's a real Christmas song, and this is it may be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. Don Murdoch, and Merry Christmas to y'all. Maybe a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me.
It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. Might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I remember as a child, every Christmas Eve, we'd sing our favorite carols as we decorate the tree. Some would tell us stories, we'd bow our heads and pray. Jesus our Savior was born that holy day. We pray for peace in the world so all can enjoy the true meaning of Christmas, the birth of a baby boy. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. Politicians try to tell us, take Christ out of the day. to hide all the symbols we used to celebrate. They say it might offend those who don't believe. Let me tell you, mister, now you're offending me. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. Why must everything be politically correct? All we need to do is treat each other with some respect. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas.
That's the Christmas song with Don Murdoch. This is Paul Fromm, back for the game tomorrow. Same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave, our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave